How did you? This is a show from radio. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week, we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Artists, get on with it.
You're listening to Shelana Gig, a radio piece produced during Dartmoor Radio Residential with Stellaria Media and supported by Futures On Air Project. This creation is a collective work done in 2 days and broadcasted on Access FM on the 17th of September 2023. An idea from Karine Demange, Jihan Marasinga, Kerry Priest and Maggie Shade.
There are bilberries growing out of that dead branch. And in fact, this tree has been hit by lightning or something. And part of that huge branch is broken off. And where the decay has formed, there are bilberries. And of course, there's also a lot of moss. That's really neat.
That's what I was about to say. It's not moss, it's food.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, this is along the western side of the British Isles, in the places where the air is really clean. You sometimes see that moss lands on trees and then you get like ferns growing out of the moss. So there's a whole like little mini ecosystems and happening on the tree branches. And that's the sign of it being a temperate rainforest.
And we've got a lot of rainforest here in Devon, actually, haven't we? Yeah.
Yeah, there are some really amazing spots on Dartmoor. Yeah, Wistman's Wood.
Yeah.
There are some spots on the High Moors where it's just... where basically they've got rocks on the ground, so there's not been any grazing animals. So it's ancient woodlands which are untouched for thousands of years. And some of the trees are completely covered in moss. And it's really magical when you go there.
I've seen sheep feeding off of the moss from the stones, from the boulders, you know. You're just looking and then you'll see a sheep, the head appearing from behind a boulder, and then it starts noshing away on a bit of moss, you know.
Okay.
I mean, I've never heard of sheep eating moss before. But there's nothing else. I mean, look at the hillside there. There's nothing else for them to feed on but moss.
Yeah.
And yet they're there. And I mean, they're behind. They're probably sheep looking at us right now, right?
Yeah.
They're wondering what on earth we're doing.
But yeah, it's good because I heard that at Wistman's Wood, they've put like a grazing barrier around to try and naturally extend the wood by, I think, 50 meters or something.
Wow.
So, and that would be a good model. They should just do that for every woodland. Just like have a barrier around it so it gets bigger. And I think they're trying to join the woodlands together a bit in the lowlands to create corridors for the wildlife as well.
Mm.
There's a lot of rewilding type stuff going on, and there's a lot of work happening with the peat as well, peat wetting, which is a really important source of carbon sequestration. So it's really, yeah, there's quite a lot going on.
It's so encouraging
here
too. Because I remember you were speaking of the Forest of Ardennes in France, but there's the Forest of Arden in Shakespeare territory. So I remember when I first moved here thinking, I've got to see the Forest of Arden, you know, and I'm going to go there. And I went, and it's nothing, you know, and that's our past here. I mean, you know, that the forests have been sort of wrecked, really, and so that there's nothing left of the Forest of Arden, which is kind of sad. I mean, it's not kind of sad, it's tragic. So it's wonderful to hear, you know, that they're trying to extend Wisman's Wood. 50 metres, that's a 50-metre success, you know? That's fantastic. And here, I mean, we're all tucked away. And this is a rainforest, you know? And I didn't even know it existed. It's just so cool to be here.
Redress the balance and make amends. A button and a cushion, a place marker, a bookmark to return to, a milestone.
Because of the river, maybe, that we can hear.
Yeah,
it's actually about the Ardennes. Now, a big part of Belgium is the Ardennes. So you have Ardennes in France, in England, and also in Belgium. And we don't have the same Shakespearean tragedy than here, because we kept it somehow.
Well, that's great. Because when it was written, it was a comedy, and now it is a tragedy. But it's good to know that someplace else there is a Forest of Ardennes. You know, and it lives on. And you got to have your honeymoon there. It's just the best.
Yeah.
Does this river run west to east? Is that, and that's north? I'm just thinking north, east, south, west. Which way is this river going?
I don't understand it.
Why is this so important to see where's the north and the west? I don't get it.
Ah, that's because we get little micro weather systems in Devon, you know, and you might read, oh, the wind is coming from the southwest today, and you'll have a vague idea of what the weather might be like. You're going to have mild weather with maybe some wet, you know, in it. But so you think, oh yes, well, generally speaking, the wind is from the southwest. But then you'll be like, hang on, the wind isn't coming from the southwest, it's actually coming from the north, and it's a microsystem that's bringing in some cold weather. And so it's just good to kind of know how things are shifting. It's also great when you put out the laundry, you know, to know which way the wind is blowing.
Yeah.
So this is the Meavy. The Plym is over that way, and that ends up in Plymouth.
Yeah, maybe that's it.
So, yeah. So they're going that way, and then they'll be going more south toward the sea. But there's so many reasons also, just, I mean, the colder wind comes from the north, you know, and then also just knowing the directions where the moon is going to rise from, and where the sun rises, and where the full moon will come up in the east, like the sun, in the, you see, I get myself in a tizzy and I get confused. So we've got the new moon now,
yeah.
So you don't see it at all, which means that the sun is not looking at it, which means that it's in the west. Am I correct? So it's all of those things that in the city, if you live in an urban space, I mean, I never thought of things like that. But now that I live in the country, everything is about, oh, the moon rises here, but if it's a crescent moon, it rises there. And the wind's coming this way today, so I expect there'll be some rain at some point. Or, oh no, well, I think we'll have dry weather, because, do you know, it, I mean, you can really, it's, you really kind of know where you are. It's like orientation, I suppose. You're oriented to, and there are magnetic fields and all the rest of it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just nice to know.
Actually, about this tree.
Yes.
There is a Japanese tradition of taking care of trees.
Yes.
And still exploit the woods, but taking care of them so that in some forests there is a technique which has a name I forgot, where you can see this forest where you have an old branch, trunk holding, and you have kind of a new forest growing in it, and they just cut this. They never cut the tree.
Yeah.
They just cut the small leaves, so you have all this, like we have here in small, you have all this in the tree, in some forest, and it's really strange to see.
Right.
They exploit it, but don't cut the tree. They just exploit the branches, so the branches go straight ahead. So the wood is still straight, but they don't need to cut the the main branch. It's
because they're sacred. 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 I mean, the trees are sacred, you know, and they have a kami. A kami is like a local god.
Yeah, yeah.
So the kami inhabit the tree. So, you know, you go up, when you go up to a tree that is specifically known to where kami inhabits, I mean, you know, you do a clap or you may want to talk to it and ask it for advice or a favor or something like that, but you definitely, before anything else, you pay your respects to it, and there's no way you could cut it down. It's spiritually not on.
It's the first thing I felt when I entered the domain here. I said, like, oh, we are not alone. Oh, there are energies all over.
Absolutely.
And it's not only about sheep watching us from, or fox or something. And I don't know how you live here. Like, how do you express it?
Well, it's weird because like lots of people, you know, I lived in the city and I was very, you know, skeptical, modern, didn't have any views like that. But living here for 7 years is just, it's like really weird. Yeah. I remember the first time I came to Dartmoor, I thought that I saw fairies and I was like, oh my God, what the hell? And I could understand for the first time what it meant to think that you could see a fairy. And like, just, you know, it's probably just flies or it's the corner of your eye, but it's the possibility. And it's that, like, and it's just, it's weird, it's so strange. I mean, it's very, very big around here, like most of the people, especially within the artistic poetry, especially, which is my particular thing, world. It's like they had a couple of, it was about 5 years ago, there was a woman, a Lakota woman, who she contacted some women around here and said that she'd had a dream that there needed to be cleansing ceremonies because of the witch trials in Europe. And so she came to Europe with native women from America, and they came and did ceremonies across Europe. And it was kind of like a weird renaissance that's happened in the last few years of loads of people calling themselves witches. And it's just really common for the, you know, like, for example, you might go to a stone circle you know, equinox, which is not particularly big time, but there might be like 100 people there when you get there. It's like really big around here, and there's just so much mystical stuff in the air, and everybody's really interested in myth. Well, not everybody, but there's a lot of interest in mythology and the occult practices and all that sort of stuff.
But what does these practices bring to you as a human being in the land? If you admit that it exists, if you admit that we need the land for these questions, like, okay, what does this part, magical part, energetic part, traditional part of the land has to bring us in our lives? Except from doing the laundry is one, but what about the rest? What about the daily life that these things can bring to us?
Yeah, it's weird because, I mean, as an artist, you know, for me it's such a huge thing that, you know, you'll sit in a place and then you'll write words and then you'll look back at those words and realise that there are so many symbols in what you've written which are to do with this day, that, you know, the goddess Epona, for example, is like the 13th of June, and you'll write a poem on the 13th of June, and then later you'll research Epona and you'll be like, oh my God, everything in this poem is a symbol of Epona. Yeah. And that's just because you've sat and observed the landscape. And it's to do with, like, there's so much within our psyches, and you don't even need to see it as supernatural. You could see it as evolutionary. We've spent so many millennia with the land that there are so many symbols within our minds which we don't which we're too cluttered usually in everyday world to access, and you have to be quiet and listen to the land. That's what I find anyway. And obviously you can bring that over into your daily life if you want to, but it's easier around here.
Yeah. No, it's profound. We have an ancient linden tree at our home, and it's protected by a tree protection order. And you wonder, how did this tree get a tree protection order on it? How did that happen, you know? It's as if the tree asked for it. Do you know what I mean? It's saying, I need to be here. I'm a part of this landscape, and I'm an integral part of this landscape. And I mean, this tree is huge. It's very, very old. And our home is built on the slope of a hill that goes down to a stream. And the root system of that tree holds our landscape together. If you cut that tree down, the landscape would be altered forever. I mean, it holds everything. And it's a sacred tree to me. I mean, I talk to it every morning, you know, and it actually centers me for the rest of the day to talk to that tree. And I'm so grateful that it's there, you know, this one huge tree. And I've tried and tried to find out why it's got a TPO on it. I mean, it is protected by the government, you know, and it's in our garden. And, you know, and the previous owners of our home said, oh, it's such a pain to have this tree here. You know, we'd have more sunlight and less shade. And we tried to get it cut down, but it's got this TPO on it. And, you know, we just feel so lucky that it's got the TPO, because we now have a new neighbor next door who says, oh, you know, that tree is so tall. If there was a bad storm, it would land on our roof or something. And we just smile and say, TPO, you know, and they can't touch that tree.
I really think that about the Dartington yew tree. Oh. It's just ridiculous. I mean, Dartington is a really cool place. It goes through lots of phases, but it's essentially a huge arts sort of complex covering thousands, hundreds of acres, with artist studios, sound art radio is based there, and it's just a place of sort of great relaxation and creativity for lots of people around here. And there's a massive yew tree in the grounds, which is about 2,000 years old. It's like, it's amazing. It's like 2 or 3 meters wide, and it's got like a huge gash down the middle of it, so it looks like a huge vagina. So it's
wonderful.
Just there isn't a better symbol of
Sheila Nagy. Sheila Nagy. Yes. Sheila Nagy. Yeah. So you really get Sheila Nagy in Devon, that's for sure. You know, I think when I lived in Oxford, I would hear, oh, that's a Sheila Nagy, and I'd be like, oh, that's strange. But here in Devon, suddenly it all comes together, you know?
Yeah.
And without even needing to explain it or whatever, it's just really neat.
It's very woman-centered here as well, which is really amazing. Like, I find it strange. If you go to some other parts of the country, you'll see, like, men kind of who fancy themselves as wizards with staffs and long beards and stuff, but you just don't get that around here so much. It's everywhere you go, it's women,
and lots of new moon circles and you know, and equinox. I mean, people meet up, like Kerry was saying, they meet up on the night of an equinox or a solstice around a fire. And you know, for us it's not 100, it's like more like 30 people or 20 people, like that. But it's still, you know, it's like we have to do that because the earth expects it of us, you know, that we turn up, you know, and mark these things the same way we mark the directions, you know. But it's almost like like the earth is telling us, asking us, inviting us to do these things. It's not like something that's learned. It's a strange thing about Devon. And it does put fairies in mind, you know, things whisper in your ear here. It's a very magical place. And it does inform your life, and it does change your life. It's changed mine, that's for sure. Yeah. No, I always thought of witches as, you know, these Herne the Hunter and all of that, you know. But no, here, I mean, there are witches everywhere, and they're lovely. Yeah, they're just really neat people.
Are you part of them, maybe?
Am I a part witch? I wouldn't mind being a witch, I think.
Maybe you are.
I could be. Maybe the earth is informing me. Hele-o-e, ahele-o-e, ahele-o-vale-no-e. That's the one that we do in Hawaii. It's the short form. But whenever you go, like when I go from Somerset into Devon, I always start in the car, I'm driving, I'm going from Somerset to Devon, ahele-o-e, ahele-o-e, ahele-o-vale-no-e. I mean, it's just sort of automatic.
And you feel it when you ask, it's about the wind or something. It can be about a fly, like, annoying you or something, say, like, you're not welcome now.
At this moment.
At this moment,
and
the way you did it, or blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the same when you pick plants and flowers and blah, blah, you ask, you know, and if there's something, you're like, okay, it's not my place, I have to go.
And then we've got lovely gatekeeper butterflies that are making a comeback. We're getting more and more of them again. But when we ask here in England, I mean, this is what I've learned from people who practice here, that often you'll actually see gatekeeper butterflies just saying it's okay. You know, they'll be like in front of you saying it's okay, you can come through here. And yeah, because like sometimes you'll pass by a tree or you cannot. You have to ask first.
Yeah, it's
a very strong feeling.
Like this one when you arrived there, you know? This one. This one I felt it like, okay. Well, I stopped to the fire and I was like, he was calling me like, hey, I'm there and I'm the boss. And I was like, okay. And we took a little time before going in, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes you don't ask, but there's something like, okay, we're in presence of something and just consider it.
Yeah, and it's so important to feel that and to sense that. I think it's crucial. I don't know why. I mean, it just seems desperately important to me to know where we're situated and what our relationship is with everything, with, you know, these lovely rocks and the moss and everything. You know, and the stories they tell. I mean, I'm sure if we, I mean, this tree here has stories to tell. It is no surprise that it stopped us here because it wants us to bavarder, you know, and all this. It's a very talky kind of tree.
And the berries.
Yeah.
Do you have this kind of asking before entering in the land for you people from here in the Dartmoor?
I just sometimes get very strong, like if I'm doing automatic writing, I get very strong messages sometimes of, and sort of realization that you're on a, like a burial mound or this sort of thing. I think there are a lot of places on Dartmoor where you get a sense of being in a graveyard, which is a strange thing, but that's,
it happens.
It really is with like rock, it's because of the rocks. You just really get that strong sense in lots of places, strangely. Granite stones, So.
That's why I keep saying it's not something supernatural, because it's actually, you actually hear it, you know, and when your automatic writing is going on, it's there and it's on the page, you know, and you are a part of that process, you know, so... And I don't really know what supernatural means, because it's, to me, this is all natural, isn't it?
It's energy, actually, just like a pendulum or something.
Yes, exactly.
It's the same state maybe you put yourself in when you have to write automatic than when you are a canal, actually, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah, definitely. I think the other thing is going back to the butterflies is definitely like animals, you know. If there's any, you know, they definitely can guide you across the landscape if you're lost and that sort of thing, especially the very rare occasion that I've seen hares have just, they always come to you at really amazingly important times. I find it's like if you decide that you're going to go and take some time to like do some research of the land and really like, you know, do some sort of art project, you're bound to see a hare. And I hardly ever see them, but it's always like, if I'm, you know, it's like a sign that yes, this is the right thing to be doing. It's amazing. Yeah.
Did you notice that there were a few friends with us? No?
Yeah, birds have come. Yeah, it's wonderful. Lots of them too.
Sheila Nagig is a collective radio piece made by Carrie Priest, Maggie Shade, Jihan Malasinga, and Karine Demange. Editing, Karine Demange. With gratitude for the good vibes and voices of Alice Armstrong, Anne-Marie Bella, Primal Bat, George Brock, Stuart Cruz, Pauline Day, Anna Drazen, Kat Guy, Lucinda Guy, Jess Langton, Sarah Lawrence, Mark Peacock, Roshani Ramas, and the Mavi River, the sources of Plym, and all Dartmoor energies and invisible inhabitants. Thanks to all of you.
Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta 2 Yankee, Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
Chemical process. 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 chemical process.
Handmade tools.
Chemical process.
Give a really good edge to the tool. Described as being against the grain.
Chemical process.
Cut the pieces.
Got a feeling for the material.
Chemical
good
process.
Shot,
along the length of the tree.
The first thing that I would do is I would knead or what's known as wedge my clay up, so to get it consistent. Because as it's been sitting around for a while in the studio, the outside may dry a little bit more than the inside, and if I then put it on the potter's wheel, I would get these kind of stiff bits, and it would make the pieces really quite hard to make. But the first thing I would do was knead that up, and in a perfect world, I would have a concrete bench to do that. But in here, I need to use the floor because I haven't got a solid enough work station at the moment. At that point, once I've done the kneading, which takes 5-10 minutes, I would then divide the clay up, weigh it up, and then use those weighed lumps on the wheel to produce pots of various sizes. So I've got an electric wheel, which is quite noisy. Yeah, and so once I've made the piece, I use a lot of metal tools in my making. So there's a lot of scraping. I use a lot of metal tools. There's quite a lot of handmade tools in here, I guess, as well. So I've got those for helping me shape and cut the pieces. And quite often I throw the pieces and get them to a point where they begin to collapse. And to stop them from actually collapsing, I use a heat gun on them. So that I use for 5-10 minutes a piece. Quite often I'll continue frying once I've kind of got them dry enough to be able to hold their own again. And once the pieces have been made, they come off the wheel, I allow them to dry out to the point where they kind of have the consistency of leather, so they're a bit movable, but they're not completely stiff, but they're a lot stronger than they are when they're really soft. And then I cover them in a white clay ground. It's a bit like kind of, I guess it's a bit like priming a canvas really. So I use terracotta brick clay. I use that because of the way that my work's developed. It's partly to do with the fact that there was a tradition of making in red clay and then grounding it with white in North Devon. Pots from North Devon, traditionally made that way, I guess about 200-300 years ago, were transported to America. There was a project, an American funded project, where they were tracing the migration of people, apparently, according to the designs that they were finding, the designs that were made around Biddeford and Barnstaple, which are the predominant producers of this, what's known as North Devon slipware. So that was kind of because it's a tradition that comes from the area in which I live. It was kind of a start point, really. So I used this white clay ground, pour that over the piece. That reintroduces moisture into the pieces and they start becoming soft again. So quite often I have to use the heat gun on them at that point. Once I get them back to leather hard, I then decorate with various coloured clays and underglazed prints which come out on the tissue. And I apply those with a brush so that I have a lot of Chinese brushes that I use. While I was doing my MA, on a travel scholarship to go to China. I used that money to go to China. And while I was there, I discovered this underglazing technique, which I think it's known as a Japanese technique. It's used quite a lot in the East, and I don't know anyone that uses it here in the form that they use it there. So I use a lot of, I use this Japanese technique, I use a lot of Chinese brushes. I find them just really work well with the coloured clay. They hold a lot of material, so I'm able to brush a lot of material at once without having to keep going back to the pot, which means I get some nice fluid marks on the pieces in there. I build up layers of colour and print to a point where I kind of satisfy that I've got quite a rich surface, at which point the piece is dry, then they go in the kiln, come out low-fired, and apply some glaze quite loosely, again with Chinese brushes. Go back into the kiln, they're fired again. At that point, quite often when I get them out of the kiln, I'll angle grind them to abrade the surface and pull some of the glaze off, and it tends to come off where the prints are sitting, because they don't, they create a bad bond between the glaze and the clay, having these prints in between. So I get these kind of, the prints start coming back through the surface of the glaze, at which point I'll fire them again, because I've scratched the hell out of it with the angle grinder, just to sort of smooth off the surface. And then at that point, if the pieces have, like, feel that they need further enrichment, and this is something I'm developing more now, I'll then use like an overglaze enamel print, which comes out in a kind of plastic film, a bit like those, a little bit like those tattoos you get from bubblegum when you're a kid, a bit like that. You apply those at that point, and they go back into the kiln and they go get fired, low firing one last time before coming out. So there's quite a lot of processes, really.
Good sharp knife.
If the tool works, then that's good enough. Got myself a Black & Decker lathe attachment.
Knitting and spinning and spinning.
Nice fluid marks on.
Put that feather and the quartz. Robinia pseudo acacia.
Scratching and cutting.
Scrounge into tips for chair legs and table legs.
Okay, so my raw material is wool and pretty much nothing else. And there are two ways of making felt. There's the ancient nomadic craft of felt making, which employs water and friction, and the friction you apply physically with your own body by rolling it or rubbing it. And the other process is a more modern technique called needle felting. And so you can either cajole loose wool fibres into a form, a three-dimensional form or a two-dimensional form, by using felting needles which are barbed down their shanks, and they basically just tangle the fibres. You repeatedly stab into the wool and it just tangles it, so it becomes a mat. But you can also, so in my case, I have the felt made on a massive loom in a huge mill on an industrial scale. So I have the felt made for me mechanically, and I can cut pieces of felt off and needle into them. So I can cut a sheet of felt and create a picture by needling other pieces of cut felt into them, or yarn. So it's almost like a sort of embroidery.
Shells and shells of dried out ball blanks.
Split willow and split brambles.
Terracotta, brick clay. I guess I go into
thin
some kind of like
porcelain slug.
Throwing, some pulling the clay up. Almost, well, not really that. You know, turning tools for carving into the clay.
A very beautiful wood.
Wedge my clay up.
A whole process.
The wooden wrapping iron. Wrapping iron?
I guess I go into some kind of like sort of meditative state almost. Well, I'm not really that. You know, I talk to myself a lot.
Embroidery.
I guess I go into some kind of like sort of meditative state almost, where I'm not really that, you know, I talk to myself a lot.
Embroidery. Embroidery. Embroidery.
I guess I go into some kind of like sort of meditative state almost, where I'm not really that, you know, I talk to myself a lot.
I think there are very few people who actually are involved in a whole process. I go out and buy the trees, I have them cut up,
I prepare
the wood, I make the items, I pack them up and I send them to a shop.
Well, not really that.
The only thing I don't do now is the accountancy side, which is my partner's taken over. So most people's working lives are spent doing one particular process in a whole big process. In fact, I think most people's lives now are spent in front of computer screens, which of course I do a bit of, but
it's
much more constructive than that. It's very satisfying to actually make objects.
It's a meditative state almost, where I'm not really that, you know, I talk to myself a lot. Rubber kidneys.
There's a dust extractor which takes the dust away.
Electric wheel.
Every hour in the workshop.
Cut the pieces.
Barium carbonate.
Burr oak.
A wooden wrapping iron, because it's boxwood, so it's quite heavy. You need something slightly heavy to compact the weave. Usually you use a metal one, but the metal one tends to pull the bark off, so I like to use the wooden one. Now I'm weaving up the sides, using one rod at a time, one weaver at a time, getting round and round. Constantly adjusting, making sure that everything is vertical, and that you're watching the spacing all the time. on this basket, the sides are sloping in, making something like that. So I've got them tied up fairly tightly. You have to be fairly fast if you want to make a living at it. The side weaving is probably the quickest bit. So once you've got everything set up, it's quite quick. It's not a fast craft, I wouldn't say. In the old days they did used to make 8 to 10 baskets a day, but they were very, very, they employed a lot of what I would call them shortcuts in a way. They weren't looking for huge quality in the finish. You know, they were making baskets for be just used in the fields or used in the boats, and they had to be strong, but they weren't regarding them as packs in the same way that we look at them now.
Chinese brushes on consistency of leather.
Every hour in the workshop.
They're level, you can keep them level if you're clever. Once they've gone out of true, they get dipped. In fact, what happens is the lower stone, the one underneath, becomes convex and the one above becomes concave, funnily enough. So you have to swap them over every now and again and keep checking the thickness. And once they're out, it can take a lot of work to get them even. They're not really quarried anymore. They were quarried mainly, the main source was two quarries in Bavaria. Solnhofen was the famous one, which is actually where they found the Archaeopteryx skeleton, you know, which is at the Science Museum. Well, it's one of these things that they are quite sought after, so people will pay quite a lot. But on the other hand, I mean, up till fairly recent, you could often find them, because they were used commercially as recently as, well, in this country, I would say 20, 30 years ago, they were still... That was the time when printers, old-fashioned printers, were throwing them out. They were used for printing labels and things, and you'd multiply up a label on a stone and kind of... you still find them with old labels, cheese labels and whatever printed on them. Right, so this was a freshly ground stone, and I've just been making some drawing on it in different ways, using different crayons and different kind of greasy inks and stuff called touche. A lot of in artist printmaking, a lot of French words, because French were such great printmakers in the 19th, 20th century. Anyway, touche is a kind of emulsion of wax and soap and stuff that is used to make these thin, kind of washy qualities here. So that's been drawn on and it's been scratched into, which is a nice thing you can do. You can scratch in the mark through there. It's very versatile medium, and you wouldn't do this on a metal plate. That's what's nice about it. It's much more organic, and you can change things, and you can recover things. The metal plate lithography, what you put on tends to be what's there. So the stone is, yeah, there's something very attractive about it. But
every hour in the workshop.
Terminology in the tools.
Now they're all slab beds. So what you do is you, from lump of big clay, big lump of clay, you slice like a thin porcelain slab. Then you pour. It's like as if you're using paper, just cut up and then join together with some strips. That's how I make like different shapes. So I don't usually use wheels. And yeah, so good thing about slab build, every part of pot is same thickness. So you can make very, very light pot, especially teapot. It should be very light. The problem of porcelain glaze, unless you put very thick glaze on, you can't get good blue, which I'm hoping to get. So although the pot itself is light, after glazing, it's become very heavy. Well, that's not nothing I can do. So first of all, so-called biscuit kiln, which temperature goes up to like 1,000 degrees, to just get ready for glaze, because glaze itself is just a kind of a ground stone material, like potash, feldspar, quartz, and some other materials. So basically it's nothing sticks to clay. So pot has to be completely dry in order to put glaze on. Otherwise glaze will run down because clay body is wet. So that's why I do biscuit firing. Most people do biscuit firing. Then put glaze on. I usually use sprayer and spray booth. The reason is the porcelain, this blue glaze, quite thick. It comes out blue. I mean, much thicker blue. So thin, getting very whiter. So if you use brush, say, you can see the mark of the brush mark, which is very distracting. So that's the reason I got this sprayer. Every hour in the workshop. Every hour in the workshop. Every hour in the workshop.
that thing about repetition that I just keep finding in
every
so many
hour in the
bits
workshop
of my life. That thing about repetition that I just keep finding in so many bits of my life. That thing about repetition that I just keep finding in so many bits of my life. About repetition that I just keep finding in so many bits of my life.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.